New York experts on black holes. Okay, so we're all in good company. Okay, so I'm gonna no equations, promise. Okay, maybe one. It's really hard for you to avoid equations. I will avoid equations as much as possible. Okay, so let me just begin by saying. Okay, so there's this saying, right? You know, everything that goes up, you know, must come down, right? Okay, so well, that's not actually quite true. Now, it turns out that, I mean, surely, you know, if I throw this guy up, then it's going to go up some number of feet and come back down. If I throw it harder, it's going to go higher, it's going to come back down again. But if I throw it hard enough, though, it will eventually go up so high that it will never come down. So if I had a really strong pitching arm and I could pitch this thing at 40,000 kilometers per hour, then that thing would sail away from the Earth, escape Earth's gravitational pull, and continue on forever out into space. Okay, so if I could pitch at 40,000 kilometers per hour, then I could pitch something from the Earth and play catch with somebody on Jupiter. Okay, we could be passing the ball back and forth like that. Okay? So there's this idea of something that has a gravitational pull, like the Earth or a planet, any other planet or the Sun. There's something called an escape velocity. Okay, that's the speed at which you must throw something in order for that object to escape. Okay, so for the Earth, we have a picture that looks something like this. Here's the Earth, and if I throw this object here, throw this baseball or whatever it is, and throw it up with some speed, it'll go up and it'll come back down. If I throw it harder, it'll go further up and come back down. If I throw it at 40,000 kilometers per hour, it will just keep on going forever. Okay. Now, that escape velocity depends upon this gravitational force. So here's my object, and here's all the particles of matter inside the Earth, and all those particles of matter are tugging on that ball, okay? And they're pulling it back. They're that force is pulling it back and keeping and slowing the object down. Okay? So now what happens if I made the Earth smaller? Okay, so I shoved the same number of particles in the Earth, same number of atoms, but I compressed it. Okay, so I compressed it to say this size. And now I'm standing here on the Earth with my little ball. Okay? But now you'll notice something. You'll notice that in the original case, the ball was over here, and there were all these particles were some distance away from that particle. Now, when I've compressed the Earth like this, then all of those particles are now, on average, closer. So gravity is this attractive type of force, not quite, we'll say in a minute, but gravity seems to be this attractive force, and that attractive force decreases with distance. Okay? So if I have two objects here, some distance apart, they will attract each other with some force. If I double the distance, that force will diminish by a factor of four. Okay, so the force gets weaker the further the two objects are apart. Okay, so in this case here, the ball is closer to all these bits of matter making up the Earth, and so the force gets stronger acting on that ball. And so the escape velocity increases. Here it's 40,000 kilometers per hour. Here it might be 80,000 kilometers per hour. And if I continue to compress the Earth, all those atoms compress them smaller and smaller and smaller, and I'm standing on the Earth here, I will feel a greater and greater weight, and this object will have a greater and greater weight, and the escape velocity, how fast I need to throw it to escape the Earth, will just increase. And eventually, if I make the Earth small enough, compress it so small that it's about the size of a marble, then the escape velocity is equal to the speed of light. Okay? And if I compress it even more, then the speed of light is greater than the speed of light, and of course, you can't pass them, nothing can go faster than the speed of light, and so nothing can escape. Okay, so that's the rough idea of a black hole. So roughly, so a black hole is sort of like this. If you have imagine a sphere like this in space on the surface of a ball like this. At some certain size here, okay, and basically it's a surface such that suppose that you're in your little rocket ship over here, and in order to keep this, this has a gravitational pull here, okay, and so the rocket ship, if we didn't blast the thrusters, the rocket ship would just fall in, okay, so we blast our little thrusters here, and we sit stationary some distance away from this surface of space. And if I were to open up the front hatch here, pull the ball out, there would be a certain escape velocity. And if I go closer and closer and closer, if I'm right next to the this is called the horizon here, if I'm right next to the horizon, then the escape velocity becomes the speed of light. So nothing can and so beyond that point, nothing can escape. Okay? So that's the rough idea of a black hole. Now, the trouble with that picture is I've been relying on Newton's model of gravity. Newton had the idea that gravity is some kind of force that acts between objects. Here's object A, object B, here's the Earth, here's the Moon. And there's some force, that mysterious force, that acts over the emptiness of space, okay, causing them to an attractive force. So well, it turns out that gravity is not a force at all. It has to do with the warping of space and time. Now, just to get a quick feel for how wrong Newton was with gravity, let me just tell you about sort of the Pauling-Hampel thing. So there's two cases. Okay, here's one case, the apple just sitting up there in the tree. The other case, the apple is falling. In which one of those cases would you say the apple is accelerating?
Both.
Okay, here it is sitting here in the tree at rest, not doing anything, okay? And here it is falling, speeding up, going faster and faster and faster. In which case does it accelerate? Second one, right? That's the obvious answer, right? And that's what Newton thought, that's what everybody thought, okay? But Einstein realized that, no, and in fact the exact opposite is happening. It's precisely when it's falling like this that there are no forces acting on it, and it is in fact not accelerating. It's when it's in the tree and there's a force acting on it, the branch pulling up on it, that it's actually accelerating. So actually the reverse is true, this is part of the whole idea that gravity is not a force and it's actually a warping of space and time. So let me talk a little bit about what that means. So warping of space and time. So let's start with warping of time in particular. So this is a concept that's it's very easy to understand, but it's hard to believe. Okay. So here I have two clocks, okay, and they're identical watches, tick, 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 tick. Okay, I take one of those watches and I stick it up here and I let them sit there for a little bit of time. Okay, and then I pull it back down. Will those two watches be reading the same time? What does common sense tell you?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, it turns out the answer is no. Okay. And what's happening is this great big rock beneath our feet, called the Earth, is warping the space and time around it. Okay. In particular, we're talking about the warping of time. It warps the time in such a way that time moves more slowly on the surface of the Earth than further away from the surface of the Earth. Okay. So time moves more quickly up here than it does down here. So if I take these two watches and they both are reading exactly the same time, I take that watch and stick it up here and hold it here, time itself is moving more quickly up here than it is down here. Okay, the little hands of the watch are moving more quickly up here than they are down here. Okay, if I let them sit there all day, okay, then the hands of this watch will get ahead of the hands of this watch. I bring them back down and I compare them, this watch is ahead of this watch. Okay? So that's an example of the warping of time. Okay? So to understand how that warping of time is responsible for this phenomenon we call gravity, let me just illustrate with a baseball trajectory. I toss the baseball and it goes across the room and it has a trajectory that's curved. Okay, so I've tossed it like this, in this direction, rather than continuing on in that straight line direction, okay, rather than continuing on like this, what it does for some reason is it goes like this. Okay? Now Newton said the reason was, well, here's this great big Earth beneath us here, and the Earth is exerting this mysterious thing called the gravitational force, and that force is causing that baseball to veer off its straight line trajectory. So it goes up like this. The baseball always wants to go on a straight line trajectory, but that force is pulling it off that straight line trajectory. Okay? And that's what's causing it to go in that orbit. Okay? Now, Einstein said, no, Newton, bad idea. All of this is wrong. No such thing as gravitational force. So what could possibly explain a curved trajectory like this? So this is how Einstein thinks about it. So actually we've got nothing around. No Earth, we're out in empty space. There's no objects to exert any gravitational influence of any kind. And we've got Alice and Bob. We've got Alice over here. And we've got Bob over here. And Alice is going to pitch a baseball over to Bob. Okay? So what is the path of the baseball from Alice to Bob? Straight lines. Okay? There it goes. Now, suppose that Alice and Bob have synchronized clocks, okay, and they're both ringing at the same time, ticking at the same rate, and Alice throws her baseball at time zero on her clock, which is time zero on Bob's clock here, okay, and that baseball goes pew, 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 flies through space like this, and ends up in Bob's hands 10 seconds later. Okay? Now, there are a couple of things going on here. So this is time according to Alice and Bob. Now, it turns out that there are two effects, or there are two things that can happen, or there are two things which affect the rate at which time moves. One of them is mass, the mass of the Earth, so time moves more slowly here than here, and the other is speed. Okay, and that's what Einstein figured out. So if I were to take a, here's my baseball, if I were to strap a wristwatch onto this baseball, okay, tick, 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 now, if I were to throw that, and Alice were to throw that baseball from over to Bob over there, okay, 10 seconds would be elapsed according to Alice and Bob, but less time would be elapsed for the wristwatch strapped to that baseball, okay, because time, motion slows down time, okay, relatively speaking. Okay, so for the baseball, time is moving more slowly relative to Alice and Bob, okay? So actually, the time reported on that baseball is not 10 seconds when Bob catches it, it's less, okay? So let's suppose that it's 9 seconds. It'll actually be, in this particular example, suppose they're like, you know, 10 meters apart or something like that. In this example, the difference will be extremely tiny. It'll be, you know, it'll be 9.999999999. Okay, but it'll be less than 10. Okay. I'm just picking a nice round number to make things easy. Okay, so the time will be less, 9 seconds, I'd say. Okay. And now something, and that has to do with the fact that in order for the ball to get from here to here in 10 seconds, it has to move at a certain speed. Okay. Now suppose that we ask, well, why doesn't the baseball take some other path, like say this path over here, or say that path? Why couldn't it take any of those other paths? Well, if you look at, say, this path over here, this distance from here to here is greater than this distance along those two paths, right? And so in order to get there from zero, Alice throws it at zero and it arrives in Bob's hand 10 seconds later, you know, on which path will it have to move faster? This path or this path, the lower path. So because this path is a greater distance, okay, the baseball needs to move more quickly, okay, and this effect of motion on the slowing down of time is greater. Okay, so this path might have 8 seconds elapsed time. This path over here, which is even longer, okay, might have 7 seconds. Okay, so basically the path, which is the shortest distance here, will be the path for which the ball moves most slowly. Okay, and so the effect of slowing down time is less. Okay, so if we look at all these different possible paths, and we ask nature, well, why do you choose this particular path as opposed to any other path? And the answer is, nature says, I choose this path because, not so much because it's the shortest distance, but because it is the longest time. Okay, that's the principle at work here. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so now what we do is we say, well, what happens if we now introduce gravity? Okay, so far we've been just imagining these Alice and Bob just floating out there in empty space. Okay, no gravitational influence of any kind anywhere. Now we've introduced the Earth. Okay, this great big rock beneath Alice and Bob here. So now they're standing on the surface of the Earth in plain sketch. Okay. So now, this thing is really irritating. Thank you. Okay. So now we stick it here, and now we notice, okay, so suppose now we throw the baseball, and again, same thing. Alice throws it at time zero, Bob catches it at time 10, and we ask what path will it take. Well, this path here, the ball is moving at a certain rate, and time is going to slow down, and so let's just take another same example, 9 seconds here. Okay, but now we notice something very important difference. By adding the Earth here, this great big rock, it warps time all around it. Okay? It warps time in such a way that time moves more slowly here and moves more quickly here. Okay? So if the principle at work here is that the ball takes the path to maximize the amount of time elapsed, okay, then there's some advantage for the ball to spend some time up here rather than all down here. And if it's floating just straight across like this, it's always moving in a region where time is moving more slowly. Okay? However, if it spends some time up here, where time moves more quickly, okay, then up here, the hands of that clock are moving more quickly up here. Okay? And so there's some advantage for the ball to spend some time up here. Okay? Now, the advantage isn't forever, because if you go too high, then again, you have the ball has to go from here to here in 10 seconds, according to Alice and Bob. And if you go all the way up to, say, the moon and back, it's going to have to be going really fast. Okay? And then you have this special relativity. You have this other slowing down of time effect. Anyway, so the basic point is there are two effects at work here for a baseball trajectory. One of them is the speed of the motion of the ball slows the time down. Okay? The other effect is the higher the ball is, time is moving more quickly up here. Okay? And so the baseball is on a trajectory, sort of a battle between those two effects. And the particular trajectory, the particular path the ball takes, happens to be exactly the path where this time is maximum, and that's for the baseball. Does that make any sense? Okay. So anyways, all I wanted to do, this is actually a fairly detailed thing. This is the hardest part of the lecture. I thought I'd get you like early when you were still, awake. Okay. So I just want to say that that all I want to get you, the only thing I want you to get out of this, or the basic thing I want you to get out of this, is that gravity is not a force. So this guy here flying across the room, on this parabolic trajectory, has got absolutely nothing to do with the force acting on it. It has everything to do with time. Okay, the rate at which time moves, and different things can affect the rate at which time moves. Speed, okay, if it's moving slowly, there's not much effect. If it's moving very quickly, time slows down. Okay, and the other effect is that time moves more quickly up here than down here. Yeah.
Do we know what there is, or you rather know what, why the Earth has that effect on time?
I will get to that. Yeah. Okay, so what I'd like to do is leave about 20 minutes at the end for questions. So I should clarify that at the beginning. So if it's possible to hold on to your questions, unless it's like just totally burning a hole into your brain and we're going to have a problem, then maybe we could just save them, please. Okay, so how do we actually know this? How do we know this is true? Well, it's very simple. How many of you know about the global positioning system, or how many of you don't? Okay, global positioning system, everybody knows. Okay, so how does that work? Basically, very simple. What you got here is you've got the Earth, and you've got somebody on the Earth here, lost in the mountains. Oh my God, where am I? And then he pulls out his little GPS system, and clicks a few buttons, and oh, there I am. Okay, phew, right? Okay, so modern technology saves the day. Okay, so how does that work? Well, you've got the guy lost in the Andes here, and you've got some satellites, 24 satellites around the Earth here, like this. And these satellites, they send radio signals. Okay, from the GPS device here, and they send radio signals back and forth, these are radio waves, to be back and forth between these objects here. And we know that the radio waves move at the speed of light, and so what you do is you time how long it takes a signal to get from there to there. Okay, so you only move the speed of light, so you can figure out that distance. Okay, you time how long it takes radio signal to get from there to there, you figure out the distance. You figure out the distance, you've got a triangle, you triangulate, and you determine position. Okay? So the whole thing relies upon very, very accurate measurements of time. Now, here's the thing. So very, very accurate measurements of time, well, how do we do that? The most accurate clocks we have today are atomic clocks. So we have atomic clocks on the Earth, we have atomic clocks up in these satellites, but now what's the problem? They're out of sync, okay? Because time moves more slowly down here on the surface of the Earth than it does up here. So if these clocks were originally synchronized to read exactly the same time, then as time goes on, since the hands of this clock are moving more quickly than the hands of this clock, they will get out of sync, okay? And the effect is so dramatic that if this warping of time weren't taken into account, the GPS system would fail in about 2 minutes. Okay, so it's important that we understand that gravity is not a force, but a warping of time and space, which we'll talk about in a second, to build cool technologies. Okay. Now the effect is very, very it turns out that in our solar system, all gravitational effects are extremely weak. Okay, and that's why we didn't know about Einstein's ideas until when he figured them out. Okay, so. But there are places in the universe where the effects of gravity are much more dramatic. And that's, for example, a black hole. So here's our little black hole. And I'll show you some pictures of real black holes a little bit later. And here's our little black hole, which is this spherical surface in space here. Okay? And it appears when you approach this thing, we'll talk about what it looks like later, but when you approach this thing, basically it's just this big, huge black sphere. It's just completely like pitch black. You can't see it. Okay? So what we have here is we've got our little spaceship here, and this spaceship is sitting some distance away from the black hole. And in order to sit that distance away, you have to blast the thrusters. And so we're blasting the thrusters, because otherwise, if you turn the thrusters off, they'll just fall in. Okay, so we're blasting the thrusters, and we're sitting some fixed distance away. And inside this little spaceship is Yuri and Veronica. And Yuri says he wants to test, general relativity. Okay, and so the prediction is that the closer he approaches the black hole, the more slowly time will move for him relative to Veronica. Okay, so then he says, I'm going to test it. And Veronica says, No, Yuri, it's too dangerous. And he says, yes, but Veronica, I must prove my bravery to you in order for it to bring your love to this now. And then she says, no, but I already love you, whatever. I know you're very brave. That haircut you're wearing, I need to go out in the world like that. You must be very brave. So he says, no, I'm going. So he goes, and he lowers himself on this rope here, okay? closer to the black hole like this. And what he's going to do is this. So there's Veronica up there in the spaceship. There's the black hole back there. He's lowered himself on this rope. Okay, it's a winch thing. And what he's going to do is he's going to wave his arms once every second, according to his watch. Okay? So he's doing this back and forth like this. And here's Veronica watching him, with tears in her eyes. Oh my God! And she sees him waving his arms like this. Okay, but as he gets closer and closer to the black hole, time is moving more slowly here than it is for Veronica. And although he's waving his arms at 1 second according to his wristwatch, according to his heartbeat, okay, according to everything that he knows as time, okay, everything's normal for him, Veronica sees his hands moving more and more slowly, okay, as he gets closer and closer to the black hole, okay, to the event horizon. And then when he's very, very close to the event horizon, he virtually stops. He's almost in still motion. And the reverse is true. When Yuri is looking up at Veronica, he sees her in fast motion, like the speed of that video. Okay? And in fact, if he spends time at this horizon here, and he's very, very close to the horizon, he can actually see all of the universe all around him moving very, very quickly in fast motion. Okay? So he can sort of, in that sense, move into the future that way. Okay? So anyway, so he spends some time over here, and the stress is just too much for Veronica, and she faints. And then she wakes up, the next day, she jolts up, and she says, oh my God, Yuri was given only 10 minutes of air. I've been like out for hours, right? And she starts winching him in, right? And then he comes in, and he's fine, right? Because time is moving more slowly for him. He, in fact, says, what did you pull me up so soon for? I was only down there for a couple minutes. And for Veronica, it was hours and hours and hours. Okay? So that's sort of one of the effects of the whole thing. Yeah. Okay. So let me talk about another effect, which is a warping of space. Okay? So now it doesn't have to be a black hole. It can be a star. It can be any object. It can be this piece of chalk. Okay. So any object that has some mass. Let's forget that for a second. Let's just imagine completely empty space with no objects around, no massive objects around. And I draw a sphere like this. Okay. And I measure the surface area of that sphere. So in other words, I give you a basketball. And you measure the surface area of that basketball. You say, oh yeah, that's 400 square centimeters. Okay? Given the surface area of that basketball, can you tell me what the volume is inside? Right. So it should be possible. It's just some simple geometry you do and you figure it out, right? Because you know the area, you can figure out the radius, you can figure out the volume, all that kind of stuff, right? It seems obvious, right? Just by looking on the outside, you can determine how much volume is inside. Now if I put a mass inside here, this might be this piece of chalk, it might be the planet Earth, it might be a black hole, anything like that. And what happens to the space around it is a certain kind of warping. And the warping is such that this mass increases the amount of space inside here. Okay? So for example, with the basketball, okay, if there's no mass inside of the basketball, then we know the relationship between, you know, surface area, and then we know the volume inside. If we put a mass inside there, then the volume increases inside. Okay, so for example, you know, it might be so that, you know, you might expect a certain amount of volume inside, but now the volume becomes bigger. So you like drill a little hole, you keep your eye in, and you see, ooh, there's a whole circuit inside there. Okay? So it's a little bit like that. So let's take the example of the sun. Okay, so here's the sun. And if you were, say, an astronaut, and you were floating around in your spaceship, and you measured the surface area of this whole big imaginary sphere in space, you would say, well, I figure there's a certain amount of volume in that space. Okay, but now when you enter into that space and start moving around, you will find that there's just more elbow room, more space inside there. You can fit more planets in there, you can fit more everything inside there. Okay? So how do we actually measure this? Well, it's actually very easy. How many of you follow the missions to the planets, NASA missions to the planets? A couple of you? Okay, so the Cassini mission, right, went to Saturn. Well, while the Cassini mission was on its way to Saturn, and it was still close to the Earth, what scientists did is they said, okay, here's the Earth, okay, and here's the Cassini spacecraft. And they sent radio signals from the Earth, okay, which passed close to the sun like this, hit the spacecraft and bounce back. Okay? So it's like radar bouncing. You send a signal back and forth, and you time how long it takes. So if there was no warping of space, okay, then there'd be a certain distance involved here, and the radio wave moves at the speed of light, and you'd be able to predict how long you expect it to take for the radio wave to come back, right? Well, when they actually did the measurement, they found that the radio wave takes longer to come back than they expected. And that's because the radio wave is moving through a region of space that's warped. Okay? There's just more volume here. Okay? As it passes closer to the sun, there's just more and more space to move through. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. So what I wanted to do now is sort of move away from the blackboard and give you a little bit of a break from the absolute theory here, and give you some really beautiful pictures of black holes. Basic message here is that black holes are real, and they're very plentiful in our universe. So let's just have a look at some of these pictures. So the first one here, this is a pair of galaxies here. These galaxies, about 100 million years ago, these galaxies had a near collision. And this galaxy, which used to have big spiral arms like our Milky Way galaxy, those spiral arms got ripped off, and all that's left is the central core or hub of stars. And this galaxy here got obviously damaged from the whole collision. So one thing just to say about this is our universe is an extremely dynamic place. But sometimes the dynamics are on scales much longer than human scales. So this is about 100. So the scale of this type of dynamic thing is about 100 million years. Okay, but we're not interested in these galaxies or in their collision process. What we're interested in is looking at this galaxy. We want to look at the central region of this galaxy because it contains a black hole. Okay, so this here, the picture on the left, is sort of a zoomed up picture from Hubble. Showing the more central region. So we take this little part of it and we blow it up. We have this picture. That right there in the very center is a black hole. Okay, a supermassive black hole, millions of times the mass of our sun. Okay, this is an absolutely beautiful picture here. So it's zoomed in on it. So let me just talk a little bit about this. First of all, okay, so I said that's the black hole, but now it looks like that's the brightest spot on the whole picture. So why is that? Right, we'd expect it to be black. Okay. So what's happening here is matter. So there's a bunch of gas and dust around this black hole, and it's falling through the event horizon. Okay. And as it's doing that, it's speeding up. It's a little bit like water flowing down a drain, and so it spirals around and speeds up before it falls down the drain. Okay. And that spiraling motion. What happens is one layer of that spiral that's closer is moving faster than a layer that's a bit further out. Okay? And so you have layers of this gas and dust rubbing against each other. Okay, so everyone do this. Your hands together and press hard and rub. Okay, you get heat, right? So that's what's happening here. That gas and dust is heating up to super, super hot. Super high energy particles are flying out here, and there's x-rays and visible light, the whole electromagnetic spectrum. There's just tons of energy coming out, okay, before that stuff falls in. Okay, now then here's another example. So black holes range in size from really, really big to much smaller. So this black hole is in the center of the galaxy M87, which is not too distant from our galaxy. And this is absolutely gigantic. The black hole here, this guy here, is about 2 billion times the mass of our sun. Okay? Now it's a real giant. Okay? What we're going to do is we're going to focus in on this central area here. So this next slide shows something very interesting about it. What scientists have been able to determine is that black hole is rotating, okay? And the way you can tell that is, so it's a little bit like, you know, when you have a siren? The siren is, the ambulance is over there, and the siren is whipping, and the ambulance is whipping down the street, and when the ambulance is coming towards you, the pitch of the siren is higher. And then when it passes you, the pitch of the siren goes down, right? Which is called a Doppler shift. Well, the same thing is happening here. What they find is, if you look on this side of the black hole, the light that's emitted is shifted to higher frequencies. In other words, all this matter and stuff and light is approaching you, and the source of light here is receding from you. So it's approaching you on this side, receding from you on that side, which means the whole thing is rotating, okay? So these gigantic beasts, 2 billion times the mass of the sun, the thing is rotating here. And another interesting feature, if we go back to here, the original picture, this guy here is a jet. Okay? So this is a clearer picture of this jet. So the diffuse yellow region here, those are the stars, the individual stars of the galaxy, and they're too small to see individually. These lesser these are little dots here. These are clusters of stars within that galaxy. And this guy right over here is the central supermassive black hole. And what's coming out is a beam, a super intense beam of very, very high energy particles, electrons, and so on, moving at close to the speed of light. Okay, so here's some more pictures, beautiful pictures. So there's the black hole. Here's that jet coming out, and here it's spreading out through space. Here's the original picture here. And now here's a radio image of that very simple region going up here. So there's a lot of interesting structure to these jets. And basically what's happening, this is a sort of artist's conception here. So this guy here, so there's a black hole in the center. And here's called the accretion disk. Okay, that's the disk of stuff, all that dust and gas that's floating around, spiraling around the black hole, about to fall into the black hole. Okay, and as it's spiraling, as I said, you got that heat effect and things are glowing, it's very, very hot. This is what you actually see. This is the really bright thing that you see, which is that accretion disk. And now there's a magnetic field here involved, just like the Earth's magnetic field, right? It goes from the North Pole to the South Pole. So you've got a magnetic field like that, but because it's rotating, that magnetic field gets twisted like this. And moreover, you've got super, super high energetic particles coming from this region here. So they haven't fallen into the black hole, and they have enough energy to actually escape from the black hole, and they're focused in this beam here, and they pull these magnetic field bars out. Okay, and so these things can be billions of kilometers in size. And these particles are moving at nearly the speed of light, this whole jet. Okay, so it's a really fantastic phenomenon. Okay, and it's very, very common. So it's widely, the general consensus now is that it's extremely likely that virtually every galaxy in the visible universe, which is about 40 billion galaxies, each one of those galaxies contains a supermassive black hole in the center. So they're extremely plentiful. Hubble has lots of images. But they're not all big. So some of them are small. So here's one that's about six times the mass of the Sun. Now this black hole was formed by a collapsing star in a supernova explosion, and it's just by itself floating through space. So there's nothing falling into it, heating up, causing it to glow. It's just pitch black, floating through space. Okay? And so how do we actually see that? Well, we see that by taking a picture. By taking a series of pictures of the background sky. So here are a bunch of stars in the background sky, taken in April. Then you take another picture later on in November, and they were just lucky enough to see that, hey, look at that. From this picture to this picture, there's something in this star over here got brighter. Okay, well, that star got brighter because the black hole passed in front of it. And so you're thinking, oh, that doesn't make any sense. Here's a star, here's us, and a black hole in the middle. If it passes in between, it should get darker, right? Well, no, it actually gets brighter, and the reason is really interesting. It's called gravitational lensing. Okay, so here's a picture of how the thing works. So basically, here's the distant star, here's the Earth, and here's the black hole. It's going to drift across, drift in front. So as it stands right now, without the black hole there, say this one ray of light hits us on the Earth, and we see this star here. Okay. Now the black hole passes in front of this, passes between us and the star here. Okay, and now, so it actually does block this ray of light, but there is a bending of light. Okay, so this warping of space and time, it means that it also bends the path of light rays. Okay, so it's just like in exactly the same way it bends the path of baseball, it bends the path of light rays. Okay, so a light ray that starts off over here, which would normally end up over here and we would never see, actually gets bent by this gravitational lens, this black hole, and it actually hits our eye over here, and similarly this ray. Okay, and then the black hole passes by and it reaches normal. So there's now two light rays you can think of it as this, right? It actually makes the star brighter. And so you can see a bit of a more detailed picture here. So here's the Earth. Here's our observation point here, and here's the very distant star, and here's the black hole right in between. And so a ray of light that starts on the star here, that would normally go off in this direction and never hit us, bends around like this, and it actually, for whatever complicated reasons, it bends in this little way here. Okay, we see an image of the star. This is actually an image of the entire star. Okay, which is sort of warped. Instead of seeing it as a sphere. It gets warped into the shape of a kidney. Okay, so the kidney shape is one image of the star, which is a kidney shape on this side, and light can also be bent around the other side of the black hole, and you have another full image of the surface of the star, which is actually amplified. Okay, and so these two images come together, and what you see are two kidney shapes, but they're so close together in angle that even the Hubble telescope can't resolve them. Okay, so you just actually see one blob. Okay, but that blob is brighter than the original star. Okay, so that's called microlensing. So that's a way of determining the existence of these black holes floating through our galaxy. And think now that at least 300 examples of this have been found. Okay, so they measure the properties of the black holes. So there are supermassive black holes, millions and billions of times the solar mass, and there are black holes a few tens of solar masses. Now here's a really dramatic example of lensing. So this picture shows me every single bright spot in this picture, every single blob is not a star, none of them are stars. They're all galaxies. So there's tons and tons of galaxies in our universe. As I said, in the visible universe, there's about 40 billion galaxies. So this is one particular cluster of galaxies. They come together in some region. Okay, so the situation is like this. Here is a very, very distant galaxy that we simply would have no hope of seeing because this is too far away. Okay? And then in between, we've got this clump of galaxies, which is this thing, all these that we see here, and then we are over here, we're observing. Okay? And so what we actually see, there are these arcs, okay? Just like those kidney shapes that we saw on the previous one, there are these arcs, and these arcs, you can see them throughout the whole thing, these arcs are actually images of galaxies much, much further away. Okay? And this galaxy in the circle here, it's very hard to see, it's a little red dot there. That red dot is one of the oldest, one of the most distant galaxies ever seen. Okay? That this galaxy, we're looking at this galaxy when it was only about 750 million years old. And that's about 5% the age of the universe. So we're looking back in time, almost to the beginning of time. Okay? to see this galaxy. And what makes that possible is this gigantic gravitational lens, okay, which brings those objects, in a sense, closer to us. So that's like a gigantic telescope floating out there in space to help us see further. All right. And now this dwarfing here, this gravitational lens effect. This is a really neat image. So this is an imaginary scene here, okay? And you've got in the center of that scene looks like a little soccer ball here. Okay, that's the object of interest here. That's the object exerting the gravitational force. So in Newton's world, if this object were extremely massive, okay, then this is the scene we would see. The water down here would not be flat like this, but the gravitational pull from that object would pull the water up like this, and you'd see a little heap of water. Okay, so this is a fantasy scene of in Newton's world. Okay, now we take the same scene, the same massive object here, and we draw this image we draw how this scene would look in Einstein's world. Okay, so there's a dramatic difference here. Okay, so Newton's world, Einstein's world. Okay, and you see a whole bunch of some visual distortions happening, which are due to this gravitational lensing. So in particular, so I don't know whether you can see this blackboard here, but everyone kind of see this? I'm not sure if I can draw something before I... Okay, so here's the soccer ball, okay? And here's a point on that red object here. So if you go back. So this red object here, we're going to take a point up there on that red object, which is sitting behind the soccer ball and a little bit above it. Okay, so here's us, here's our eye. Okay, and here's that point, which is a little bit above the soccer ball and behind it. So now, in Newton's world, that ray of light would just take a straight line path like this. Okay? But in Einstein's world, that ray of light which takes off in that direction would actually be bent toward this object, okay, and it would actually go this way and we wouldn't see it. Okay? It's actually this ray of light up here, okay, which starts traveling a straight line here, but because of this massive object, it gets bent around and it actually reaches our eye. Okay? So instead of seeing that point up there, instead of seeing it in this direction here, okay, which is in Newton's world, we would actually see it upwards, higher up, at a higher angle. Okay? Okay, so in Einstein's world, we see that point not over here, but we see it way up there. Okay? And moreover, we can see sky in between. How's that possible? We see sky in between because if we take now an angle lower, okay, let's say this angle, what happens is that light gets bent all the way around the object and goes and so actually from a point in the sky way up here, that light can come like this, bend around the entire object, and come back to our eye. Okay? So we can actually see the sky in between. And in fact, if this were actually a black hole, you would see an infinite number of copies of the entire scene between here and here, just multiple copies as you go in and in and in. And notice something interesting about the soccer ball itself. Okay, so if we look in Newton's scene here, okay, the top of the soccer ball and the bottom of the soccer ball, you can't see those. Okay, but because of this bending of light, okay, light which takes off from the top of that soccer ball can actually bend up and then come into our eye. So when you look at in Einstein's world here, you can actually see the top of the soccer ball, and you can actually see the bottom, and you can see actually multiple copies of that soccer ball around the outer rim here. Okay, so that's some of the visual distortions produced by just the sort of working of space and time and the effect it has on light. Okay, so here's an interesting video here. This is a video showing us what it would look like to approach a black hole. So I'll just run the video a couple of times here. So the black hole, of course, the black hole is this red thing. And of course, we wouldn't actually see that. It would just be black. So it's just been made red so that we can actually see it. Okay. Now, there's a certain point at which, let me just see if I can get the mouse here. seeing here is three different stars here, three different colors. This is a great big blue star. And so we are approaching this scene, which means the black hole and these four stars, three stars. And right now, at this particular instant in the scene here, we see two images of this star. One of the images is the original star, is the main image, okay, which lies above the black hole, okay, in this direction. But we also see a second image of that star, because light, light can come from that star and go below the black hole and come up. Okay, so you can see it actually below. So there's the second image of the black hole. And there are actually multiple images. See, there's the blue thing again, and the green. There's multiple images of all of these stars around, because the light is going around that black hole once, twice, three times. Okay. And then if we continue on, and now we're actually pretty close to the black hole. Okay, and you can see that this is the north pole, sort of speaking, of the black hole and the south pole. And you can see that it's distorted enough so that you're actually seeing around the north pole and you're seeing the south pole. So you're seeing both poles of the black hole. And in fact, if this diagram were drawn with sufficient resolution, it's actually true that you can see basically an infinite number of copies of that surface over and over again. Okay, so now let's move to orbiting the black hole. Okay, so this is what it would look like to orbit the black hole. And so you see, basically, what's happening is we're just going around like this, and this blue star is, as we go around the black hole this way, that blue star is moving up over our head and behind our head and back again, and coming back like this, right? And you can see that there are times here where you can see multiple images of that blue star, and so on. Okay, so now what happens when you actually fall into the black hole? It's something like this. Okay, so. Now, it's a common misconception that when you fall into a black hole, once you pass the horizon, you can't see the outside universe. But of course you can, because there's still, light is falling in, and you can actually see the outside world. So you can see the outside world until the very last second, when you hit the singularity in the center of the black hole, where the gravitational effects become so strong and violent that you're just completely destroyed and compressed to a zero size. So there are a variety of here. So let's just stop it. So we don't have time to talk about this in great detail, but I've given you a website where this is, and we can have a fantastic explanation for this online. So as soon as this white thing appears, these white lines appear, that means you've entered the horizon and the point of no return, and you're never coming back into this universe. Okay, and what you see is this sort of event horizon, that surface, that spherical surface sort of splits into two. Okay? And as you go further and further in, so let me just stop it one more frame. So you see here that blue star is very, very distorted. And as you go further, and it gets more and more distorted. You're now inside the black hole, and you can still see the blue star outside, even more distorted. And it gets so distorted that eventually all of the scene outside just appears in a sort of at your face. Okay, so all in that kind of plane around you. And then eventually you hit the singularity here. Okay, and then the picture beyond this is you're dead. this is a fantastic, this is a beautiful image here. So what this shows is a series. Oops. Sorry about that. Here we go. So what you're seeing is two neutron stars. They're very, very dense stars. They, in and of themselves, they are not black holes. But when they merge together, when they collide together, they will form a black hole. So this is a numerical simulation, a very, very difficult calculation with Einstein's very complicated equations, showing how exactly two neutron stars would merge together and form a black hole. So the instant that this red grid appears, this is now the event horizon. If you cross past that point, it's now a point of no return. And the reason why these calculations are being done, it's a very, very exciting thing, is if okay, events like this are happening all over the place in our universe, and when they do happen, they cause changes in the warping of space and time around it, which move outwards like ripples in a pond. Okay? So there are warp space time can move like waves. Okay? And then they can reach us on the Earth here, and we can attempt to detect, we can attempt to measure those ripples in space time. And what that will allow us to do, so right now there are, I have listed in the handout there, when you leave, there are some very, very interesting projects that scientists are currently working on, which will allow us to actually detect, or we may allow us to actually detect these ripples. And why would that be interesting? Well, everything that we know about the universe, and it's quite a bit, we know all of that from the electromagnetic spectrum, from light, from radio waves, from X-rays. Okay, so in other words, when we are able to see the universe. Okay? And every time we open up a new sort of spectrum, say so the visible light, we go into infrared, and we learn all kinds of new things. We look at the universe with X-rays, and we learn all kinds of new things. Okay, well, now what's happening is, in the next several decades, well, what may very well happen is an opening up of an entirely new window where we don't see the universe so much as actually hear the universe. We hear the ripples and the warping of space-time. Okay, and we may even be able to, one day, actually hear the sound of the Big Bang. Okay, it's an absolutely fascinating new window on the universe. Okay, and calculations are being done exactly of this type, to try to get an understanding of what it is we're going to hear, okay, when we turn these listening devices on. Okay, and finally, just want to show you. So here's our. This is a spiral galaxy, which is generally believed to be what our Milky Way galaxy looks like. Okay, so there's sort of like, you know, it's kind of like a you are here. So we're somewhere here, and our star, the sun is somewhere over here, and the whole thing is right. This central object. Now, most of these galaxies have black holes in the center, as I said. But I should come to the correction here. An interesting note is that it's just assumed that our galaxy is spiral in spiral type galaxy. But I have it on good authority that astronomers at the University of Waterloo here some time ago actually showed that our galaxy is not a spiral galaxy like this, but it actually looks more like this, a barred spiral. Okay, so it's probably more like our universal stuff. Our galaxy looks like, so our planet is over here, and solar system over here, and we want to look into this region here. There's a lot of dust in between there, so we can't normally see there, but if we use infrared light, we can penetrate through that dust and see what's actually the center of our galaxy. And I'll show you a picture of what's the center of our galaxy. Okay, this is amazing footage. This is the coolest thing I've ever seen. This is a picture of, so right there, that cross there is the center of our universe, which contains a 2.4 million solar mass black hole. And now it's not bright. It's not bright like the other ones that I showed you because there isn't stuff falling into it. Our galaxy is very old. All that stuff has been used up. And so it's just sitting there floating by itself without a lot of stuff falling into it. Okay, so it's just black. But we can still observe its effect by seeing the gravitational effect it has on stars orbiting around. Okay, so these are all stars very, very close, or right near the center of our galaxy. So these were images taken over from 1992. You can see the date on the upper left to 5 years of data. Okay, so you see the stars moving around. Okay, so it's a very dynamic region. Actually, goes up to 2001 or whatever. Okay, so several years, you can see those stars moving around. Now we're going to zoom in, and we're going to take a closer look. Okay? You see stars moving around. This star is the important one. Okay? So that star here, you see how it whipped around like that? Okay, so it whipped around, and it passed very, very close to that central black hole. It's 17 light hours. That's the time. That's a distance that light would move in 17 hours, which is very tiny on the scale of the whole galaxy. Okay, so it passed very, very close to that supermassive black hole, and by studying the orbital parameters of that star, scientists could determine the mass of that black hole as 2.4 solar mass, 2.4 million solar masses. And there's one more here. This shows the same black hole in the center of the galaxy, which is invisible here. It's just dark. Okay, and here it is. Here's an object. This is a very rare event. Here's this black hole heating up a star. So to see it get bright like that. So when that star fell in, then it heated up, and there was this last sort of death scream. And just before it fell, kind of fast the event horizon, and there was this bright flare. Okay. So, anyways, that's so I'm gonna turn the lights on. So there, close your eyes for a second. It's gonna be bright. Right. So I'd like to just close with and blah 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 with saying why it is that black holes are so important, and there are a couple of reasons. One reason is, as I said, there are black. It is generally believed that there are black holes in virtually every galaxy in our universe, and so they play a big role in the evolution of our universe and the evolution of galaxies and so on. So it's really important to understand black holes, to understand how our universe evolves, to change its shape, and all that stuff. But the other reason, which is very important for us here at Fermi Institute, is it is the theoretical aspects of a black hole. So Stephen Hawking is a very famous guy, and he's famous because basically what he did is he showed us that three different areas of physics. Okay, thermodynamics, which is the theory of heat and glowing, you know, if I take a hot object and fire, it's glowing warm, it's glowing red. Okay, like thermodynamics, and gravity, Einstein's theory, and quantum mechanics. Okay? These are three very, very separate areas of study. And the idea in theoretical physics is to bring these areas together. And what Hawking did, he presented an argument that showed that black holes aren't black. They actually glow a little bit like a coal glowing in fire. Okay? And so there's thermodynamic properties of black holes. Okay? And to show that required truly quantum phenomena. So at the end of the day, the point I'm trying to make is that black holes sit sort of in the center here, and they are a focus to bring these things together. And they are a place in which these three very separate and very important areas of physics overlap. And he said, hey guys, look at black holes, study them in great detail, because they are a place where these three things come together in an important way. And so they form an extremely important laboratory of the mind. So I know I'm going to run out of time here. So if you have a quick question, I'm sorry I went a little bit longer. I didn't realize that slideshow was this long. So if you have a question or two, maybe we can get.
How long ago did they discover the first black
hole? That's sort of hard to say because the evidence kind of mounts. It kind of becomes more and more convincing as time goes on. It's not like, bang, this is for certain a black hole. The evidence sort of comes in dribs and drafts, and then it becomes, and then the confidence level just increases. So I'd say within the last 10 years, there's been a tremendous surge of evidence. Just a flood of evidence that shows all kinds of activities going on in the universe that are just almost virtually impossible to explain without assuming that what's responsible is a black hole.
So did the concept of the black hole first and the evidence?
Absolutely. Yeah, so Einstein, created his theory of warp space time back in 1915, 1916, and then a very short time later, Karl Schwarzschild, working during the war, working in the trenches, he was calculating, and he figured out the black hole solution. So black holes were known way back in 1916, 17. So they were discovered just by thinking alone, just by pure thought. There was absolutely no evidence for them. And the evidence started coming in probably in the 70s. Yeah.
Does anything cause a black hole to disperse? Or?
Yes. So this Hawking radiation, this the fact that a black hole isn't black is that it's glowing and it's emitting energy, it's emitting radiation, and that radiation, energy and matter are essentially the same thing, and so that radiation that's coming out is carrying energy waves, so it's actually at the expense of the mass of the black hole. So the black hole is actually evaporating. Okay. Now, it's not actually clear whether that's what's really happening. That's a contentious issue. And it's a huge issue. It's not at all clear that Hawking's calculation is correct. Okay? I mean, it predicts this, But there are a lot of, there's a lot of argument and debate whether or not it's actually a valid argument. But the point is, it doesn't matter. So what I'm saying is, don't think that this Hawking radiation is absolutely some kind of scientific fact, because it's not. Okay? It's just a very powerful idea, a very powerful argument. Okay? But there are little loopholes in this argument, and it's not yet clear whether or not it's true. Okay? But the point is, it's completely irrelevant whether Hawking was right or not about this radiation. The point is, he caused scientists as a whole to focus on black holes, and he caused all these minds to focus in this direction, which is producing an enormous amount of valuable insights and new ideas. And so that's the value of that Hawking radiation idea. Whether or not in 10, 20 years, whatever, we figure out it was right or not. I mean, probably it's right, but it could very well be wrong. Okay, but that's irrelevant at this point. Yeah.
Why were there was some black holes in a black, none of that chunk ground, which is gas and everything else, and some have other gas being sucked into it that then causing that light? What's the difference between those two points? What makes them different?
It just depends upon whether or not the black hole was created with stuff around it. So suppose you had an isolated star that was nothing around it, like our sun. Our sun is basically by itself. And if our sun can't do this, but if it was large enough, it could become a supernova and create a black hole. Then all the stuff would be dispersed, and you'd have a black hole sitting there all by itself in space, with no matter around it to fall in. Whereas typically in galaxies, at least early in the universe, the black hole is there, and there's tons of gas and dust and stars around it, which can fall in. And then create that intense radiation energy coming out.
So it kind of depends on the age of the black hole then.
Yeah, in certain, like for galaxies, it depends upon the age, but for that's for supermassive black holes. For smaller black holes, it depends on what environment they were created in.
What the greatest black hole in the galaxy?
You know, I don't think that's known. I think that's an area of active research now. The question is, what created black holes in the center of all these galaxies? So there are two possibilities. One is they were there right from the very beginning. So during the process of the Big Bang, you had these black holes created in some way, and they served as seeds for the galaxies. The other is the black holes formed after the galaxies formed. Okay, so the galaxies were already there. There was a central region, and it became dense enough in a black hole form, and then more stars fell in, and black hole got bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay, so it's not quite clear. I don't think there's any definitive answer for that at this point. Yeah.
According to Hawking's theory, if a black hole is evaporating, in a sense, what effect would that have on a galaxy?
Very little. When a black hole is large, so the radiation looks like this. This is the size of the black hole. So this is large. This is small. Okay. So as the black hole evaporates, so it goes from large to small. The amount of radiation that's coming off, it starts out very small, and then just before it evaporates and completely disappears. Well, it's not clear what happens at the end, whether it's good or not, but so just before, it just grows exponentially like this. And so for the longest time, the radiation is extremely low intensity, so low intensity that we would never have any developing technology to see it. And especially given that there's all kinds of other dynamic things going on, we would just be completely drowned out like everything else going on. It's only when it gets to the very, very last stages that there would be an intense burst of radiation. And also, the mass would have decreased, and so I guess the question is, maybe I didn't say that clearly. So as the mass decreases, smaller and smaller and smaller, and the orbits of all the stars, because you got to realize that a galaxy, there's this sort of central mass, and all the stars in the galaxy are orbiting around that central mass. And so as that central mass decreases, then those orbits would get looser and slower, okay? and the galaxy would sort of disintegrate like that. Yeah, that's probably clear answer. And I think that we probably should go. I'm sorry. Yes, we just probably clear the roof and let in.